Right, I think that'll work.
Good morning, everybody. So, by way of exhortation, I am going to consider a couple of the verses that are taken out of Psalm 56. And if I was going to put a title on this exhortation, it would be the title, Tears in Heaven. I guess some people might be familiar with that title because it's kind of borrowed from a fairly popular song. But it's the story about coming to terms with grief and loss. And I guess it's an appropriate week with the passing of the Queen, which is a very sad time for many in the world, not just the Commonwealth, but many in the world. She was such a gracious lady and she had such an amazing reign. And I think, you know, the influence of her reign and the divine providence and things that happened are quite remarkable. And perhaps seen just in that incredible picture that probably everyone saw with the double rainbows sitting over the palace. That was quite poignant. It was almost as though, you know, God acknowledged this wonderful woman. Tears in Heaven, of course, comes from another story of loss. It's a song which was composed by Eric Clapton, and it was written and composed on the very tragic loss of his four-year-old son, Connor, who fell out of a 56-story apartment building in New York and sent Eric Clapton to be completely reclusive, and for a number of years he really struggled with the story of this tragic, unexpected loss of his child. It's deemed to be perhaps the saddest song that's ever written, and when you sort of really listen to the lyrics, you can see Eric Clapton desperately trying to come to terms with his faith and what happened. And what's interesting, when you compare these two things with the story of the Queen and the story of Eric Clapton's son, there's something interesting in that, you know, we've been expecting the Queen to pass. We've been waiting for her to pass. Her health has been failing. She's old. She's come to that time. And the nation has been preparing this. England was ready for the events which would take place and the processes, because they knew that, she'd come to the end of her life. Whereas opposed to Eric Clapton's four-year-old son, this was just unexpected. This was just out of the blue. This was a tragedy that nothing in his mind could have prepared him for what happened. And I think in life, there are things which we might, you know, come in terms of grief and loss to be prepared for, but when the event actually happens, I think really still prepares you for grief and loss. So it sent me thinking back, because obviously with Mum's passing, I spent a lot of time going through old photos and different things and thinking back to my childhood days. And I was thinking about back when I was four, thinking about Eric Clapton's son, and I was thinking about, you know, times in my childhood playground. And see, we had it pretty cool in Pitaru because it wasn't really like public playgrounds back in those days, but we didn't need it because we had like the most awesome playground you could imagine, because Dad was a bit of an inventor, a bit of a hobbyist, and so he wanted to make things, and he was always making things, dangerous things really, very very dangerous, but back then there was no health and safety, and the fact that if it got past Mum, then it was okay, we were all allowed to go on it. So anyway, here's a picture of our childhood playground. Well, at least that's the way I might have remembered it. But that's not actually a picture of our childhood playground. But in the process of going back through photos, I did actually find a picture of our childhood playground. And all the kids in the neighbourhood would come. And I remember this from four, because there I am at four, sitting on this giant swing that Dad had made. And there's a whole lot of my cousins there. That's Les and Lynn's kids. But some of these pieces of equipment which Dad made, I think this one here was like the first ever like pig on a spring, and that was a pretty dangerous sort of piece of equipment. And then there was, obviously the giant swing, and There was a trampoline he made. You don't want to talk about the trampoline. It would definitely have not have passed any health and safety inspections. And numerous times people ended up in the garden or through the trampoline when the canvas tore. But you know, I loved all of that, and I loved everything about our playground. I loved the swing. I even loved that, you know, pig on a spring, and I loved every part of it except for one thing. There was one thing that was in our playground which I was terrified of, and it tormented me. And it's like, all of these things were cool, but the one thing that really tormented me and terrified me out of all of our playground pieces of equipment was the seesaw. I know, you're thinking the same thing, eh? You know, what's so scary about a seesaw? With seers, I'm the youngest sibling. So the thing is, when I'm four, my older brother at one stage was nine. He's 4.5 years older than me. So when I'm four and he's nine and we're out there playing, while mum and dad are watching, our seesaw was like this, by the way. This is kind of what it was scary. It was one that went round and round as well, but we didn't have bulls chasing us. But when we were out there playing and mum and dad were watching, it kind of went like this. It was really happy times. Mum was there. Everything was going good. But when mum and dad went there, it was more like this. And the thing is when I look back and think about this, there's something that's really kind of powerful in this story. Because the first thing you do and the thing you react when that happens is that inbuilt into us is this trigger from children of our emotions, which are generated and expressed through tears. And you know, in terms of all of God's species, we're the only species which actually have emotional tears. There's three different types of tears that, you know, we produce, but emotional tears, humans are the only species on God's planet that produce emotional tears. And it's obviously there as part of something which God has put within us. And it's natural when you're young to do this. Of course, the reaction from the older brother is, cry baby, don't go tell mum and dad. He's really worried that I'd be in trouble. But we have this in us as an emotional outlet, something that we have and to show emotion and to show we cry emotionally because of joy. We cry emotionally because of pain and loss. There is a lot of emotional reasons within us that we cry. Sometimes we just cry because we hear something just so beautiful. So it can be just something which generates in us this incredible emotion. So music brings about tears. Pain and sorrow bring about tears. Happiness bring about tears. And you see, when you're young, that's a natural thing to do. But as you get older, that's not a cool thing to do, especially not in the Western world. We don't do that. You know, we don't show our emotions that way. And so we kind of go through this process that when you get older, those childhood memories, those things which were traumatized you in the background as a child, they can haunt you in the past. And those things which were bad experiences then can become terrifying experiences in the future. And so what happens is we get to this stage where we don't want to play anymore. We don't want to be a part of that game, and we live in the shadow of the trauma of the past. And no matter how much, you know, things in our life might be trying to get us to play, we've, like Snoopy here, we put our feet up on the bottom of the seesaw, and we don't want to go there. Now, we've lived in a world where this has happened. You see, the reason why the seesaw was so traumatizing is that of all those playground pieces of equipment, I can control being on that pig on a spring. And if I fell off, that's my fault. I can control being on a swing. And if I fell off, that's my fault. But the problem with the seesaw is I was completely reliant on the behaviour and actions of my brother, on how that experience went. I needed him to play the game. And so it's out of my control. And what happens when something happens that's not in your control is that's when things, you know, distress us the most. We don't like things that happen out of our control. And we've been living in a world where this has kind of happened to us, hasn't it? Last few years, we're living in a world where there's a whole lot of things which are being forced on us, which we feel like is out of our control. And so, of course, you've got this pent-up emotion about what our rights are or what this is, and we don't like this. So I think there's a lesson on the seesaw that we can think about. You see, in the story of the seesaw, we have experiences that happened to us in the past. And these experiences that happen to us, they can often cause some very negative feelings or emotions. We have trauma, which, like, we get PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. So trauma can affect us deep down, and it can sit within us for a long time. We might have regret because of the things that we never did or accomplished, the things we should have done but we didn't do. Or we might have guilt for the things we did do that we shouldn't have done. And so you have these things, and like Newton's law, like the seesaw, all of these things that happen to us have an equal or opposite reaction. And it's true that, you know, trauma brings fear for looking to the future. Regret can be looking at anxiety, because you can sit there and be anxious about what you weren't and become depressed about what you are. Guilt can bring certain uncertainty. It can bring failure. It can be suddenly thinking, I'm useless. I've failed over and over again. So all of these things that happen in our past can have an equal and opposite reaction in terms of what happens in the future. And one of the amazing things when you go through the Psalms is that when you cry when you're young, it's a natural reaction to express those feelings, to let go of all of those emotions. But we don't do it when we're older. And, you know, for me, watching my dad, you know, going through the trauma of mum's passing, when I was young, Dad was Superman. Like, he was tough. He could fight three of us teenage kids at the same time. I never saw him cry. But as I've watched and seen him go through the things which happened with Mum, it's like, this is a whole different strength. This is a whole different man that has spiritual strength, not the physical strength that I remember when I was young. And when you go through the Psalms, think about the way the psalmists express their emotion. It's incredible. They screamed to God. They just poured it out. Look at some of these Psalms. Psalm 6, verse 6 to 8. I'm weary from groaning with my tears. My bed is drenched with my tears. Every night, every day, my eyes are swollen with grief, and I grow old because of mine enemies. Depart from me, all you evildoers. So you can see in this expression just how powerful some of these psalms are. Psalm 42, my tears have been my food day and night. All day long, people saying, where is your God? Day and night, morning and night. Psalm 69, I'm weary from crying. My throat is parched. My eyes fail for looking to God. And this one's a combination taken from the Message translation, which is quite liberal, but a little bit there from the Christian Standard Bible, which I've kind of plucked and picked a bit out of both for this psalm. But it says, my eyes are worn out from crying, O Lord, worn out from crying. I cry out to you all day long. I spread out my hands to you. I'm standing on my ground, God. I'm shouting for help. At my prayers every morning, on my knees each daybreak, why, God, do you turn a deaf ear? Why do you make yourself scarce? As long as I can remember, I've been hurting. I've taken the worst you can hand out. I've had it. Your wildfire anger has blazed through my life. I'm bleeding black and blue. You've attacked me fiercely on every side, raining down blows till I'm nearly dead. Have you prayed like that before? Look at the expression that's coming out of this. This is raw. This is really raw. But it's honest. It's deeply honest, isn't it? And you can feel the emotion of the psalmist just letting go and crying and pouring out to God. And we need to do this as adults. And we find it all through the Psalms. Because if you don't, you know, if you've got this thing built inside you, these tears which allow you to express your emotion, and you don't let them out. Psalm 32 says, "For when I kept silent, when I didn't let it out, my bones wasted away through groaning all day long. Night and day your hand was heavy upon me and dried me up by the heat of the day." All of a sudden it's like eating out inside. Because, you know, of course, when you bottle something up, it's dangerous, isn't it? And that's what happens with us, is that sometimes we don't want to express emotion or fear or pain. So thinking about the story of my growing up with my older brother and my experiences in the playground and those things which traumatized me, I was thinking about the story of a couple of other brothers. Now, obviously you might know these two brothers. They weren't 5 years apart. They were more like perhaps about 5 minutes apart. So these two brothers, of course, the story of Jacob and Esau. But I think in the story of Jacob and Esau is something really powerful. And I want to pick up for our exhortation a little bit on the story of Jacob and Esau and a little bit on the story of the Lord Jesus Christ. But come with me to Psalm 32. So quick background for this, you should be familiar with this story. Jacob ran away from the face of his brother when he was just the sprightly young man of 77 years old. He left home. So he left mum and dad's home, and he was left home, and he left home terrified of the fact that his brother had this look of utter hatred and was going to kill him, and made a vow that he was going to kill him. And of course, Esau was the hunter, and I imagine those two boys, when they grew up, and they played hide and seek, when they played the game, I could imagine which one was the seeker, and which one was the hider, because we know which one was the hunter, and which one dwelt in tents. And I could imagine when the hunter, or the seeker, caught up with the one that was hiding, what would happen. It would have been a traumatic experience as Esau suddenly took on the role of fighting a lion or something, and poor old Jacob was going to be at the mercy of his brother. So he knew what his brother was like. He knew he was a mighty hunter. And he ran away from home, terrified him, and spent 20 years away. And when he came back after being 20 years in the house of Laban, his biggest fear was in front of him. He was about to face Jacob again. And he was utterly, completely terrified. And so in Genesis 32 is the story that God meets him. The angels of God meet him in the way. And they meet him, Genesis 32 verse 1, and God is obviously saying to Jacob, "It's okay, Jacob. I've got this." And Jacob pours out his heart to God in verse 9, and he says, "Lord, you promised me you'd protect me in the country, and now I'm returned, and I'm afraid." And he pours out his heart, and he's open with God. And verse 11, he says, "Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, for I'm afraid of him, that he'll attack me and my wives and children. But you said you would do me good, and my offspring should be like the sand of the sea." So here you've got this picture of God coming to him with angels and saying, "It's all right, Jacob, I've got this." And then Jacob praying and saying, "Help me, help me, help me." And then the next thing that happens Jacob goes into frenzy mode to prepare this incredible bribe to try to pacify Esau. And he sends these gifts one after the other in droves to try to send them to Esau. And he gets the message back, what's happening? Esau's still coming. He's still coming. That's like he's given all these gifts and all these presents, but Esau still marches forward and he's terrified. And he gets up in the middle of the night and he's terrified in the middle of the night. And he's got his camp with his family there and he's sneaking out in the middle of the night. Why? Because he remembers his brother. This is the hunter. This is the guy that for 20 years Jacob has expected to see his brother suddenly pounce out of nowhere in the dark and attack him. And now he's got his wives and family and Esau's this close. So he's out there watching. Where is he? Where is he? Where is he? And all of a sudden, bang, out of nowhere he gets attacked. A man jumps out and attacks him. And he fights with all his might, with all his strength. And he fights 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 and he fights. And he's wrestling all night long with this man. All his strength, all his power, all his might. And then in the beginning of the daybreak, the angel man, of course, turns out to be an angel, touches his thigh, biggest muscle in your body. Just touched it, like little finger. Oof, shrinks. Biggest muscle in your body, and he touched it with his finger. Voom. Boom. Becomes a cripple from that moment. All his strength, all his might, he's wrestling with all his power, and at the end of the night, an angel touches him and weakens him, and he becomes a cripple. Now just put that in your mind and think about this story. This is Jesus in the garden, and he's wrestling all night long. And he is in the fight of his life. Just like Jacob. But the difference is, Hebrews says, in the days of his flesh, when Jesus offered up prayers and supplication with loud crying and tears. Now, Hebrews adds that, in the days of his supplication, he lifted his voice with loud crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death and was heard. So you picture this scene in the garden. Jesus goes into the garden and he's not wrestling God, he's wrestling himself, because he says it, not my will, not my will. And Jesus is in the fight of his life, not wrestling God, he's wrestling himself. And he's pouring out, he's screaming, he's crying, and then he gets up to go from the garden after pouring out heart, soul and mind, and he gets up to go and he says, I can't do it. I can't do it. And he goes back into the garden and he goes through it all over again, crying, tears, pouring out heart, soul and mind, and then he gets up to leave the garden again. It's like, I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm not ready. And he goes back. And every time he poured out his heart and cried from deep within, he gained more and more and more strength, didn't he? And then an angel of God appears and touches him and strengthened him. And he went from that garden ready to face the cross. Complete opposite to the story of Jacob, who wrestled God and was weakened at that end of the story by the touch of an angel, to Jesus, who wrestled himself, heart, soul and mind, and found strength. And that's the thing, is in the story of this we find that, you know, there appeared an angel from heaven strengthening him. And in this process of tears, there is a process of cleansing, but there is a process of strength that we find. Our exposition for this morning, the Hebrew word for tears, but Hebrew is very interesting, by the way. Like the Hebrew's letters always kind of portray, illustrate the meaning of a word. Oh, So there's the Hebrew word there. It's the Hebrew word demor. And if you see, it almost looks like the Hebrew letters are actually crying. So this is the idea behind the Hebrew words actually betraying this idea. And what's interesting about this Hebrew word for tears here, it literally means tears. Yeah, that's amazing. That's tuck that away and put that away. That's just your big exposition for the day. And it always appears as tears or weeping. But you know, there is a cognitive word which is almost exactly the same in the Hebrew. That means the same ideas, but it only appears once in the whole of the Bible. And it's the word demar. You'll notice it's actually in the actual Strong's. It's only sort of one number away from it. And it has the idea of the liquid that is squeezed from a fruit, in particular the grape. And this is the only time it appears in the Bible. You shall not delay to offer the fullness of your harvest from the outflow, the squeezings of your presses. And then it says, the firstborns of your sons you shall give me. You see, here's the point, isn't it? You have not resisted unto blood. He poured out every drop. His sweat became great drops of blood. Every essence was squeezed out in that garden until it was squeezed out as blood, poured out. And that's what we remember today. And in thinking about our life, we remember this. This is a classic saying from the Mind Journal. No amount of guilt can change the past. No amount of anxiety can change the future. But he can. He can change the guilt of our past. He can change the anxiety of our future. And any amount of gratitude can change the present. Any amount of gratitude can change the present. So, what do we learn from the seesaw? Is that between the regrets of our past and how we face the future is what's in the middle. It's finding the balance. And this thing in the middle of the seesaw is called the fulcrum. It's where balance comes, between balancing everything that happens in the past and between what's happening in the future. And Paul puts it this way. He says, forgetting those things which are behind. He forgets what's in the past. He says, I reach out for those things which are ahead. He says, because I am able to do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Christ is the fulcrum of our seesaw in life. He is the balance between anything that has happened in the past, and he is the strength for whatever may lie ahead in the future. And so here's my little acronym for fulcrum. Having faith and understanding, the love of Christ restores unity and motion or balance. So if you want to think about an acronym for a fulcrum, it's thinking about how the power of the love of Christ restores balance. It restores unity. It gets us going on the seesaw of life. It helps us to play the game again. Psalm 56 says, you keep track of all my sorrows. You have collected all my tears in your bottle. Every bit of pain, every bit of suffering we experience, God knows, and it's not wasted. It doesn't fall aimlessly on the ground. He collects it in his bottle. And the psalmist says, you know, you've preserved every single piece of suffering that I've endured, and you've collected it, memorialized it. We're going to see the memorial emblems of a man who poured out his soul unto death and sweated great drops of blood, tears of blood. And in each one of these glasses is a memorial unto that. And God has kept it, preserved it, memorialized it for us. So our final two quotes Revelation 21 verse 4, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death, mourning, crying or pain, for the old order of things shall be passed away. And then one more, I think, beautiful quote from one of my favourite psalms. You know, just as no amount of preparation can prepare you for trauma. You think about Jesus in the garden. He knew everything that was going to happen to him. He said to the disciples, the Son of Man is going to be betrayed, he's going to be arrested, he's going to be scourged, he's going to be spat upon, he's going to be crucified. He knew the detail of what was going to happen. But when he got to the garden, it was overwhelming. It was just overwhelming for him. And so he drew strength on just crying out to God, crying out to God, crying out to God. And it's the most powerful lesson for us. It's like sometimes you need to go back and do it over and over and over again. And if you're not feeling right, cry again. Pray again. Pray deeper. Pray harder. Pour out heart, soul, and mind, because in that you'll find strength. But just as no amount of preparation can prepare you for trauma or for loss when it happens, especially when it happens suddenly, no amount of preparation or learning can prepare us for the joy which is before us. Psalm 126, and perhaps we can just finish with reading this beautiful Song of Degrees. Psalm 126, when the Lord restored the fortunes of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter, our tongue with shouts of joy. They said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. We are glad. Restore our fortunes, O Lord, like streams in the Negeb. Those who sow in tears shall reap with shouts of joy. Those who go out weeping, bearing seed for sowing, shall come home with shouts of joy, bringing their sheaves with them.